Great. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Farnam Jahanian, Assistant Director for SCIFES here at the National Science Foundation. On behalf of my colleague here at NSF, it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the first distinguished lecture on Designing Disruptive Learning Technology series. I'm really excited to be here this afternoon with you. In a moment, I'm going to turn it over to Janet Klodner to introduce our speaker. But let me say a few words about our cyber learning program and also this speaker series. As all of you know, as learning platforms merge with more online and interactive models, we're seeing some transformative activity, democratization of education and learning, richer collaboration, and of course opportunities for sharing, helping to create a richer learning experience, both in formal and informal settings. Not to mention automated assessment, better data collection, more systematic evaluation of teachers and students. And of course, there are many implications for formal and informal education, including for our academic institutions across the country. But the real potential is improving learning by integrating emerging technologies with knowledge from research about how people learn. Just last month, I'm sure most of you have seen this, NSF posted a solicitation called Cyber Learning and Future Learning Technologies. This is a new opportunity that builds on years of investment by various directorates at NSF, including EHR, SCIFES, and SDE. This new opportunity, now with a new name from the former Cyber Learning Transforming Education solicitation, continues the NSF support of the work that aims to integrate research on emerging technologies, as I mentioned, with knowledge about how people learn. I am personally excited about this because of the terrific collaboration that's taking place involving the SCIFES Directorate, our colleagues in EHR, as well as SDE, and we're going to build on that. And I neglected to mention that this year, actually, our Engineering Directorate is also part of this solicitation. So a lot of great things are going to come out of this collaboration. The research that's supported through this program will help to create a systematic interdisciplinary body of knowledge on how to design, implement, and effectively use technology to support learning assessment and how people learn in technology-rich environments. The Cyber Learning Program, as we call it, is just one example of many that exist throughout the foundation that support research on learning with technology. I'm sure you're also familiar with our significant investment in Science for Learning centers over the last few years. We're also very excited about this series and for the opportunity to showcase projects funded across NSF programs that focus on imaginative new ways in technology can be used to help people learn. As I'm sure this series will illustrate over the next year or so, the transformative potential of learning technology are terrific. Learning technologies will enhance our ability to collect and manage data, to give personalized real-time feedback, and of course, to promote better learning overall. Before I close, I want to thank the members of the working group, the NSF Cyber Learning Working Group, that over the last several years, especially during the last year, representing all directors, especially SCIFES, Engineering, EHR, and SDE, and also want to thank Janet Klodner for her leadership of this effort. Let's give her a round of applause. This has come as a result of all of their hard work over the last few years, especially the last 12 months. Again, I want to thank all of you for coming here, and I'm going to turn it over to Janet to introduce our speaker. Janet?
Hi. Can you hear me okay? So I'm Janet Klodner. I'm co-lead of the Cyber Learning Working Group. We're the people who put that solicitation out and will be looking at all the proposals and whatever. What I wanted to tell you about this series is that the goal of this series, what we wanted to do, is help people imagine what's possible with technology. And so I'm really delighted to have Tom Moore as our very first speaker, because Tom has come to be known as one of the creative and imaginative designers of technology-rich learning environments in the whole learning sciences and learning technology community. Okay, he's on the faculty in computer science at the University of Illinois in Chicago. For the past decade, his research has centered on the intersection of human-computer interaction and learning technologies, focusing on the design of ubiquitous technologies, that is, technologies that are all around us, okay, and embodied activities to support young learners. That is the kind of activities that actually use our bodies, and to support young learners in classroom-based inquiry, learning science. I'm really pleased to have Tom kick off the series, as I said, and without further ado, Professor Tom Moore from the University of Illinois, Chicago.
Thank you for the introduction. Hope you don't raise your expectations too high. I want to thank everybody who helped me get here today. I had a reschedule from January, and this is the season of rescheduling, so I'm really happy to be here. It's a great opportunity. I'll try to go quickly today because I know we have introductions and guests and external people. I want to talk about some work that we've done, and by we, I mean not just me, but me, my graduate students, my collaborators, and a bunch of teachers over the past about the past 10 years in the area of designing STEM learning experiences in elementary school classrooms, with a particular focus on activities that support whole class activities, engaged in extended inquiry exercises. And Jen, when she asked me to give a talk here, she asked me to try to really give a feel for the classroom. So I'm going to be trying to do that today, give you an idea of trying to situate you in those classrooms, and I've got actually a fair amount of video, which is going to squeeze some of the talking time, but I think it's worth it because I think that really helps convey the message. I
need my next button. Can I drag that over here?
Oh, cool.
Can I do this too? Then I won't do that.
So which one reads?
Yeah, beautiful.
So I want to start with a couple of quotes. At my age, I'm kind of unabashed to cite supportive fun as a basic human behavioral driver. And I suspect, and so it gives me the opportunity to quote one of my favorite philosophers. But I don't mean it in a facetious way. I think I probably find a lot of buy-in with the notion expressed by one of my colleagues, Andy Johnson, here that for me, and I expect for a lot of you, science is fun. And I'm interested in trying to break that down a little bit and think about what I mean by the components of fun. What makes something fun? What makes science fun for me and for classroom learners? And just thought of a couple of characteristics of what I think are fun, and I want to elaborate on this just a little bit. Fun has to involve something accessible. It has to involve something that is there, is stuff local that I can get my hands on, it's proximate, it's immediate somehow. I want to make accessible a range of phenomena, so I want to, in classrooms, not restrict myself necessarily to the kind of phenomena that can be contained within the space, but allow us to imagine things that may come from other places. And I want fun to allow me to be productive in some sense. Fun, if it's accessible, means I can make progress on it. I don't get stuck still somewhere and unable to move forward. When I think about designing designing activities that are active, a little circular, the first question that always comes to my mind, question I think I carried through from when I was a kid, was what do I get to do? What's involved here? What's the action here? What can I do? And I think that could be cognitive action, could be social action, but I'm especially interested also in a physical action, as Janet mentioned, the idea that there's an activity structure that's interesting enough to engage me. I don't like movies with predictable endings, and I don't think kids like activities that involve things where they know the outcome from the outset. So I'm very interested in trying to design activities that have some element of surprise, some element of the unexpected. I think sharing is important. Sharing, learning how to collaborate with each other for work is an important thing that we need to do, but also just to have others to share my fun with, to share the social experience with at the same time. And perhaps most of all, experiences need to be fun, it has to be hard enough to be fun. You know, it's the difference between the Monday and the Saturday New York Times crossword puzzle. You've got to have something that engages you. So fun usually to me means it's kind of got to be long, it's not a short-term experience. It's got to be somehow, you know, authentic and a discipline. I got to feel like I'm really digging in deeply somehow. And I do this through the design of relatively long-term investigations. Our activity designs usually run in the order of 6 to 8 weeks, typically, in our design. So my work is about having fun. forward. I forgot about this slide. And one of the techniques that I use actually in developing my designs, I want to have these pictures up here, is working with fun scientists. I found a great source of inspiration by working with domain scientists who describe to me with great passion the kinds of work they do. And these are a couple of my research partners. It's not much of a picture of Debbie, but it's a good picture of Joel, whose name you can't see there. It's Joel Brown. So we'll move on to the next one. So here's the place that I want to have fun. I love working in classrooms. You know, there's a lot of talk about the constraints of classrooms, about curriculum, overcrowding issues, too large of class sizes, about budget. But, you know, to me, classrooms are also full of really interesting design affordances. We have a captive audience. We have a community that gets to know each other very deeply and very well. And most of all, we have an adult in the room who knows something about learning and cares about those children and coordinates their activities. So I see those as real assets. And I think about, you know, sort of embracing the constraint of the classroom as a fun design challenge. One of my inspirations, there we go, in thinking about the way the kinds of activities that I wanted to design, harkened back to when I was in elementary school. And when I was in sixth grade, I had a very creative teacher, and she organized for us a trip to the moon. And we broke into little teams. One team was responsible for designing the living quarters, so we went out and got cardboard boxes and, you know, made people crawled into spaces and figure out where we put our food and where we put our clothes and things like that. Some of us planned the trajectory to the moon. Others were concerned with navigation, all sorts of different aspects of it. The coolest thing, she brought an old big refrigerator box. Couldn't do this these days because of fire hazard, but big refrigerator box, put it in front of the door of the classroom, cut an extra door, and it became the door lock. And every time you had to go in or out of the classroom, you had to first equalize pressure in the intermediate stage. So I love the creativity and the playfulness of that. I love the make-believe of that. The problem was at the time, we really didn't have the technology to take it, because I'm old enough, we didn't have the technology to take it very much farther, to really make it something operational that we could play with in a deep way. So we never got to go to the moon. We just kind of got to plan to go to the moon. And I'm interested in trying to find a way to kind of go to the moon, although I never really built that one. So a couple years ago, we started to think about a framework that really tried to utilize the room, that where we could use the space, the physical space and the physical time of the classroom to try to really enact, to use technology to enact in a way that would make it richer for us, that would make more pieces, more dials to turn, more stuff to see, more stuff to do. And just to very briefly give you the framework of embedded phenomena, and I apologize, this is my only moving slide. The idea with embedded phenomena is, there we go. So we start with a classroom, and this works. Okay. And the idea is that we ask the kids, and here's the mental part. We ask the kids to imagine that coincident with our classroom, coincident with our physical space and the time that we're spending doing spelling and reading and all those things, that there is some phenomena that's occupying the space at the same time. Okay? The idea is to try to, you know, both embed the children within the phenomenon itself and also to embed the phenomenon in the classroom. So I've been starting to talk about this as sort of a coincident reality. It's not quite augmented or mixed reality or virtual realities, but it's two realities that are going on at the same time. It's two distinctive threads that are connected by some portals. I got that little wiggle out there. The idea is that the way that you access this from this phenomenon is through these boundary objects, these locations in the room that give you kind of the blind man and the elephant view of what's going on with this phenomenon. Now, these are spatial phenomena, so the location of these portals into the phenomenon within the classroom are location-specific. The kind of view I might get on a stationary computer or on a portable device in one part of the room is going to be different than the view I would get in a different part of the room, and obviously they also are going to vary across time. The idea, you know, with the portals was, you know, it's sometimes called this kind of a Swiss cheese reality. It spreads activity around, and it also provides an opportunity to let kids have an experience with what I would call kind of a mobile science practice. You know, the image of scientists often is canonically of a bench scientist, but the idea, especially with a lot of the science domains that I work with, the field scientist, science is a very physically active and challenging and interesting area of potential exploration, an area of potential careers for kids. So the idea for them that, you know, you get to move around, and the fact that you have to move around because you need data from different locations, I think is appealing to a lot of kids. The these representations run all the time, at least ideally. So the idea, I work mostly in self-contained classrooms, and the idea is that these representations, even though we are doing spelling now, or we're doing reading, or we're doing social studies, these representations are up all the time and running. So the idea is that I want to immerse the kids, you know, sort of in the time frame of the phenomenon. I want to maintain their salience for the kids all the time, let them become familiar. Sometimes I use the term marinating the kids in these phenomena. It also affords me the opportunity for surprise, the element of surprise that I was talking about before, because things happen, nature happens when it happens, not because it happens to be science period right now. It also has the advantage, I think, of sneaking in a little bit of extra time for science, which is sort of needed in elementary school. Finally, when children engage these phenomena, engage in investigations of these simulated phenomena over multiple weeks, giving them always a collaborative exercise where we need the collective efforts of the entire class to gather the data we needed, to reflect on those data, to identify the patterns that we're looking for, and also because I wanted to afford kids time to engage. So they run into kids whose immediate attention to a new activity might be a little off-putting, not particularly interested, but after a while, if these are surrounding you all the time and everybody's engaged with these activities over multiple weeks, at some point it becomes easier to participate than it does to continue to blow it off. So that's one of my hopes. I'm going to take you on a Cook's tour of a couple of these embedded phenomena. And the first one I want to talk about, that unfortunately that picture up in the top is right where all my slides titles are, but this is an application called Roomquake, and this is one of our first embedded phenomena. And the idea here, the nominal question, we ask the kids to imagine that we are situated in an area that's a very, very active area for an area of an intense amount of seismic activity, and that we're going to be, for some reason, expecting that we might have a lot of earthquakes, we call them roomquakes in this class, over the next couple of weeks. And we not only give them the question, you know, give them the challenge of determining where the fault line is in our classroom. So we suspect there's a fault line, there's a boundary between two plates, and we want to find out what that is. So in order to do that, we need to track a series of earthquakes over time and find out what patterns evolve and see if we can identify that fault line. We're really interested in two things from a learning perspective. We're interested in the question of how do we know about individual events? How do we know this really started with a conversation with a domain expert where I was asking, well, how do you guys, I knew vaguely, but how do you guys exactly figure out where earthquakes happen? Earthquake happens, they're reported in a particular location. How do we know that? There's no sensor there. So we get kids to get into the notion that there was a process that, this process of using multiple seismometers and trying the process of trilateration to determine the epicenter of quakes. So we wanted to focus on that interpretation, that task, how that gets accomplished, that practice of earth scientists. And also, what do we know, what can we learn about patterns of earthquakes? We already talked about the emergence of fault lines, but there are other patterns, too, in the distributions of quakes, in terms of their temporal distributions and in terms of the distributions of intensities. We know that there are a lot more very mild quakes than there are very strong quakes. So the way we set this up in the classroom was we started initially years ago with little handheld PDAs, and we eventually moved to larger screens because they afford more kids working around them at the same time. But the idea is we distribute these around the classroom in known locations, and we shrink everything down so that we imagine that instead of talking about hundreds of kilometers, our trilateration is going to be in terms of a couple of feet, okay? And every now and then, the seismographs run all the time, mostly showing simulated flat noise, and then at scheduled times that we know about, that the kids don't know about, obviously, we have a roomquake. And when a roomquake occurs, the task of the kids is to go and interpret the seismogram, and the graphs will be different in each location because the distance of the quake from each of the Seismographs is going to be different. So they have to go and interpret the quake, determine the distance of the quake from their particular seismograph, and that will be different for each of the kids. And the way that we affect trilateration, since these are fifth graders, rather than try to do this mathematically, find the intersection point in three circles, I went to Home Depot and bought some dry lines, and we marked them off, you know, basically as tape measures. So the kids pull the strings out to the appropriate distance, they sweep out the arcs, and their point of intersection basically affects the trilateration, more or less. You know, not always comes out exactly right, but they get it pretty close. And then when they determine the epicenter of those quakes, they mark them. Can't do it on the floor because the custodians need to clean up. But we've been using the ceiling, and typically we hang styrofoam balls if we have drop ceilings. We put little sticky markers on the ceiling and in these tall Chicago tin ceiling classrooms to indicate those quakes and their magnitude. So we see a physical representation of the accumulation of these data over time. And I'm going to show you a brief video of what that action looks like in the classroom. Let me set this up just a little bit. We begin the video with a video conference with a woman named Debbie Kill, who's a seismologist out at Scripps. Debbie was my domain expert, really, on this project. And Debbie's having a conversation with the classroom, and, of course, we scheduled a quake while she was having that conversation so she could get some idea about what the action was like. So I don't know if this will fire up by itself. The mouse it. There we go. You can just launch that, yeah.
Can you guys hear that? Not very
well.
Some reasons, like down here in Southern California, New Guinea, there's a million quakes on the generator here. We're reporting here in San Diego right now.
So you'll see kids going through, interpreting the seismographs, and doing their trilateration. And you'll see some negotiation over the interpretation.
And you will escape the question recording by the station.
Well, there was a subwoofer too. Gotta have a little sensory. We're looking at the difference between the arrival of the P wave and S wave in terms of distance. This is going on in multiple stations around the classroom. So I'm not going to go a lot into outcomes right now, but I wanted to give you one example of one of the student work products that came out of this. This is some kids who are taking a look at the distribution of magnitudes of quake over time. And what's really interesting, we know that there are a lot more weak quakes than there are strong quakes, but actually there's a nice inverse relationship that's logarithmic, and it's called the Gutenberg-Richter law. And these kids actually got very close to it down here. Okay, so it's a very naive but, very simple representation of it. But some work that they did to, to understand something about collections of quakes rather than just individual quakes. Turning to another one, an application that we call Aqua Room. The nominal task here was that we had a factory that we needed to bring into town. We needed the jobs. It was a good thing that the factory was coming in, but it was a chemical factory, and we wanted to make very sure that any outflow from the factory did not have an impact on our water system. So our task was a task of hydrogeology. We wanted to determine where we imagined that the classroom was a small town and that we were sitting on top of a network of aquifers, and we challenged the kids to try to find out where those aquifers were. So the work involved with that, the way that that's done actually is that hydrogeologists will inject dyes, typically, we did them as colored dyes, but they would actually be isotopes of various kinds. They inject dyes, and then they start to sample around the point of the injection to see if it migrated from the original injection site to another site. So we engaged kids in activity, and their job was to try to find out, by doing those injections and extractions, if they could find out what the paths of the, we simplified it to make them pretty coherent aquifers, they could find out what the paths of those aquifers look like. So the equipment that we used to do that, I'm going to walk away from this for a second, but we used tablet computers as sort of portable drilling stations. Okay, so what we did was we took these tablets, we attached a couple things to them. One of the things we attached was an Ethernet cord to which we we taped a suction cup at the very end. So totally functionless, but that served as the drilling instrument. Okay, so you had to get to the ground to get at the stuff. We also connected, I don't know if you guys are familiar with iButtons, but they're these simple one-button reader systems. We put these little readers on here, and they read these little metal-encased things that have unique identifiers associated with them. I'll get back to that in a second. So the kids would walk around with these, find a place that they wanted to do their drilling. And by the way, they located themselves using a grid system based on the tiles and the ceiling. So they had a report. We didn't have any automatic tracking here. You had a report that I was in row A and, in column 7 or something like that in order for it to work. So the kids would walk around. They would do their drilling. And the way that they would inject and receive samples was we took a bunch of test tubes and glued eye buttons to the top of the test tubes. So what the kids would do is they would walk over, and by attaching your test tube to this little reader, what we were imagining was that the dye would then flow down through the drill, through the Ethernet cable, into the ground, inject the dye, and then vice versa, if we wanted to collect samples, we had another kind of test tube where they'd come back and collect the samples. When they received a sample, which we knew about because of its unique ID on the eye button and because of the location that they reported, they would go over to this simulated spectrometer and plug it in there and take a spectrometer reading, so they would see what colors had emerged. And they had a little chart next to that talked about the various wavelengths of the different colors. And then they would go and report that on a table. And let me give you 2 minutes of that. So we'll go to the next one and start that one. So you'll see this action. So you see the young lady over here, she's drilling.
We're doing
A3. They love crawling around on the floor. I'm sure. I'll answer that question later. So this is the spectrometer. So they had to learn to preserve their sample. They couldn't lose it along the way. That's good. We can cut that one. So the final product then was this map that they're drawing, and I'll show you what it finally turned out to be. And they were indicating which sections were just rock, there weren't any aquifer. They had to find the sections that did have water, the flow in with them, and you'll see some recommendations about potential locations for placement of the factory up there. The question was, did they believe it? There's a range of answers to that. We actually asked kids about this as explicitly. There were a few kids who, you know, who believed that there was actually some flow into the ground. And it's a really interesting question, the balance between make-believe and raising horrible misconceptions. We don't try to deceive them. And it's, you know, usually tongue-in-cheek, and we're always surprised sometimes when they take it more literally than they expected. But, yeah, it does happen a little bit. Another more recent one is a an activity that we call Hunger Games, and you've gotten into some trouble over using that name. This is an activity that we're actually using the kids' own performances as our data rather than using simulated data. In this activity, what we do is we used RFID stations situated around the room, decorated with a bunch of leaves and things like that to indicate various food patches. So we're interested in kids. So in this particular classroom, there were six different food patches of different richness situated around the room. And the challenge to the kids was to try to act as the challenge we gave them was, could you make it as a squirrel? And so their job was to try to forage by moving from station to station and trying to get as many calories as they can by attending to things like patch richness, competition, and later predation. Okay, so we did by putting them in the penalty box, not by killing them. They were merely maimed. They were not killed. I'm not going to show you the video of that because I'm afraid we're going to run out of time if I get into that too deeply. But in this activity, the technology, what we did was the way that they foraged. We originally thought, you know, we could use their bodies and use lanyards or wrist bracelets or something to do that. It really turned out to be difficult to do with RFID technologies in classrooms, given all the attenuating materials around the classroom and the children's bodies. So what we ended up doing was buying a bunch of stuffed animals and embedding the RFID tags in there. So the way that you would do it, you had a little avatar which represented you, and you could go over and leave your guy in the food patch for a little while, and then if you saw a better opportunity somewhere else, you could go over and do that. So again, we were getting them to attend to both the strategies of individual agents and what would work best for them by attending to, you know, competition, those sorts of factors. But also we were looking for the emergent property that came from that, which was the emergence of an ideal free distribution, the fact that populations of animals will distribute themselves in ways to, you know, take maximum advantage of the resources that are available. So just, and you'll see, again, we're going to skip that picture, but we'll skip the video. But again, you see, you know, examples of a poster that some of the kids made describing the distribution, and it was based on their own performances, the number of calories they each had collected. So you can see that they actually did equalize fairly closely. It's scary to go into that wondering whether it would really normalize, but consistently it seems to happen. So it's kind of nice. Science works. So what are we learning? Move on to the next one. I'm not going to go much into results here, but I think we're learning something about, I think we're being fairly successful at getting the kids to situate themselves in the virtual space, even though they're physically in their own classroom. This was a count of words based on some interviews that we did with kids in the aqua room activity, where we're kind of trying to see, was their language in describing their activity going to be about the room and about computers and things like that, or was it going to be about things like aquifers and water flow and drills and wells and things like that? And we saw some tendency, in fact, some reason to believe that, in fact, they are situating themselves in that space. We have done, you know, more formal sorts of pre-post tests around kids' activities. This was some work that I did with Jenny Wiley several years ago, where we created an embedded phenomena version of room quake, and then we took one where we situated it in California instead. We did it all on wall maps. We had none of the embodiment. Okay, instead of experiencing it in real time, we just gave them a series of 12 quakes. We took a look at the differences in their learning, both around the science sort of practices, the skills demonstration of ability to read seismograms and things like that, but also into conceptual issues, and we did see some advantage to that too. A really interesting outcome of that one was that we also gave the kids the test of spatial abilities, and the participation in the embedded version of this seemed to mitigate differences and mitigate those sort of initial differences in spatial reasoning. So we've seen, you know, one of my hopes was that what I said before, that participation, that if you're marinated in this long enough, that you eventually, even if you blow me off at first, you know, that you're willing to come in and join the activity as time goes on. And we saw that
for some kids, we saw some kids get bored. This is a graph, by the way, of their participation in the first half of the unit versus their participation in the second half of the unit. So kids above the line are kids who got more into it, started to become more active in participation. Kids below the line are the ones that decreased their participation over time. So some very high ones. High learners probably got bored out here. We had some success stories up here, but we still have some over here to work on, where kids were not, where that, you know, the advantage of time didn't buy necessarily a whole lot. We also learned something about how long these things should be. So Roomquake, in order to get a good distribution of earthquake magnitudes, you need quite a number of quakes. Even now we're using an exponent of 2. It should really be a it should really be 10. This takes a look at, we were taking a look at distinctive roles that kids could take on. They have a lot of latitude in what they choose to do at any one given time. So we're taking a look at their choices and how much they had spread those choices out. So we wanted them to experience not just being the guy that, you know, that holds the end of the string or the girl that interprets the seismograph, but to experience the range of activities. And we can see that we were starting to get, you know, relatively marginal gains probably about halfway through. There wasn't maybe that much to gain when we got out here. So we, in fact, have done some redesign with that so that they don't have to do so many of these quakes. It doesn't have to be quite so repetitious. I want to talk very briefly, so I leave a few minutes for questions, about some more recent work. Up till now, most of the things that you've seen, most of our representations have been paper and pencil and physical materials. Been using technology to manifest the phenomenon, but not necessarily to support knowledge construction. And about 3 years ago, I started a collaboration with Jim Slotta's group at the University of Toronto. Jim's work had been all around the use of technologies to support community knowledge construction, and we started to put that work together and move some of the things that we've been doing in a physical and tangible space, as great as they were, into a digital space that were a little more malleable, allowed us more flexibility of representation, more transformations on representation. So I want to skip a couple things here. So I'll take you through one more embedded phenomena, which was our first big project together around this. So this was a merger between the embedded phenomena idea and, in using technologies for knowledge construction. So we have an application that had gone back some time called Walkology. In Walkology, the conceit is that unbeknownst to us, up till now at this point in the school year, the walls of our classroom actually contain a very carefully designed habitat, which is protecting some endangered species. It's a secret government facility that's in the walls of our classroom. And originally, we used to provide access to this ecosystem by literally Velcroing tablet computers to the wall, which I think was cooler. Now we use larger displays to afford more kids seeing it. And we use a fake cable, and we just tape it to the wall like it's a camera that they can see in there. And the idea is that they have to monitor. The idea is that this ecosystem, this environment, which is being controlled by some scientists. All the scientists are going on vacation, and we're turning it over to the kids. And the task for the kids is to try to maintain the biodiversity in this environment. And they have the ability to control some of the environmental factors in the space. So they can control temperature, light, humidity, and those sorts of things. And the idea is, you know, we don't want any of these species to die out. So what they see are, you know, simulations of bugs crawling around, creatures crawling around, of vegetation and things like that. They have to determine life cycle changes in these species to identify which things belong with which other things. They have to identify the food web in this space by looking and seeing who eats whom. And they have to monitor the population levels by sampling from small spaces and then making estimates about the number of creatures that might be contained in the whole space and also even the amount of vegetation. We literally lay tracing paper on there and they draw around vegetation and count cells to see how much stuff there is. Okay. What happened in this project that was really interesting was, so we had had that on the table, and what we brought in was the work that Jim's group had been doing around knowledge building tools. So we started to use tablets that allowed the kids to enter both their immediate observations about what was going on. So when we were doing things like taking counts, we accumulated those counts and we were able to form graphs and things like that out of their raw counts. But also as they started to build understandings, started debates about what's going on in this space, started to add more text and images, we were able to accommodate that as well. So they had a system for notes, akin kind of to if some of you are familiar with, like, the Knowledge Forum sorts of stuff. And we also built a lot of tools for teachers to work with this, to work with the notes that kids are accumulating and to orchestrate activity in the classroom. And I really wanted to show, I'm going to probably end with this, and it's a relatively long video, but I think it's worth it. When we started, we thought of this as primarily a technology integration activity. What it became was something incredibly richer. We had the opportunity to do literally, our whole design team certainly spent several hundred hours of design and redesigning the activity, adding modeling capabilities, changing the whole trajectory of this, and opening it up from a much broader inquiry perspective than simply tracking population levels over time. And this was one we had just a tremendous opportunity to work with teachers as really authentic partners in the design of this activity. So they were there with us from the very beginning, very challenging to us, and made it much better in that way. I wanted to show you this. This is a little bit of a fanciful, it's a little bit of a Ken Burns-ish kind of video. I didn't make it. One of the graduate students up in Toronto made it. So bear with me a little bit, but I think this will give you a real flavor of the use of technology, not only for the manifestation of the phenomenon, but also the way the technology was being used in order to help them collaboratively build knowledge within the classroom. So, it's got music, I apologize. I just didn't have the chops to cut it out. There's a lot of video in here too, not just still. You'll get better. And laugh and things crawling around.
If there was a major decision, the population. How would we know if Benjamin theory is correct, that things are actually moving to see the habitat?
I just wanted to give you an idea of the range of materials and range of technologies that were being used to support the activity. So you saw physical materials as well as tablets that kids were using to make contributions to, and search knowledge base, and tools that the teachers were using, in addition to the manifestation of the phenomenon at the same time. So fairly tech-heavy. Just a couple words, 2 minutes about where we're going. In the project, in my continuing work with Jim, we're taking a look at a couple of other things. One is this notion of in these knowledge systems sometimes there's a tendency for them to become more of a write-only system than a write-and-read system. So kids are readily able to make contributions, but finding material that's actually useful to share on the way out can be a real challenge. So we're looking at the idea of, instead of requiring kids to make a poll, make explicit queries into these into knowledge bases, of actually pushing this knowledge out to them through ambient technology situated around the room. So becoming aware of the kinds of contributions that others have made, becoming aware perhaps of representations of progress of the entire class toward particular answers that they're going for, and trying to see if we can use this space the way that ubiquitous technologies are used in the rest of society. And one last one. Oops, we missed one, but the other one I was going to talk about was the idea that the knowledge contributions have tended to be a very sort of small format, almost Twitterish kind of thing, little bursts that kids put out. So we're interested also in taking a look at knowledge contributions which may be a little larger in grain size and larger physically. So something more along with the idea of posters, where we'll reduce the cardinality of the knowledge space, so that also is a way that they might be able to find things more easily and more likely to be able to leverage the contributions that other kids have made. So just 1 second here, I'm just going to say, I think we've made some progress on issues of accessibility, activity, and surprisingness. And I think the really hard challenges that we're focusing on now are sharing and continuing to make the activities meatier, making them hard enough and interesting enough that they can engage 25 kids over a period of multiple weeks. And just end by saying, science, fun isn't just for the kids. We have a lot of fun in what we do, too. This is our research team, my group, and Jim's group up at Toronto. And a plug for this afternoon at 2:30, if you want to come by and experience yet another embedded phenomenon that we call Helio Room, we're going to have a little workshop here where I'm going to put you in the position of the kids for a little while and give you an opportunity, if you're interested, to think about designing your own embedded phenomenon. So, okay, we're kind of a race, but thank you. Yes.
Yeah. So, I love everything you're doing. It seems great.
Except.
No, I just think that there's a risk involved in doing virtual things. So these kids are growing up in a world in which they encounter an increasing number of things in a virtual space, in all kinds of online things, all sorts of computer-mediated things. So how do you know that these kids believe that these rules of science that drive these simulations are really the rules of science and not some completely arbitrary set of rules of science that were developed by grown-ups and just put upon them? Just like in all these online things that you have to deal with, there are completely arbitrary sets of rules that are put upon us.
Okay, so I would say, first of all, I'm pro-real. Okay, there's another whole branch of my work where, you know, we're going outdoors, we're working with real phenomena, so... The idea of the embedded phenomena is really that we drive them by simulations. They can also be driven by real events in the real world. So I'm not anti-real. I'm not, you know, pushing the notion that simulation is the only way to go. I don't know what the answer to your question is, Anthony, other than trust. You know, I guess in some sense they have to trust us that we're not trying to mislead them. We are misleading them in some ways. These are models. These are representations. They're always going to be feature some elements at the expense of other elements. We do try to spend time talking about the fidelity of our models. When we talk this afternoon, in fact, I'm going to be talking a lot about that. We'll take a look at our models and have the kids critique our models specifically with respect to real-world phenomena. But at other times, you know, I think it is an article of faith. They have to believe that, you know, we're not trying to intentionally mislead them. And make it part of the discussion.
Good, thanks.
Yeah.
Well, to follow on to that, are there opportunities for these students to get out of the classroom and do some of the real world science, or because they're in Chicago on city streets, it may not be as possible?
Yeah, well, some things you can do and some things you can't do. There's not too many earthquakes in Chicago.
Right, but is there, I mean, to
but yeah, take the foraging. We haven't done this yet, but our next round of the foraging stuff, we're going to actually take kids. We'll do the foraging simulations, but we're also working with actual experiments. You can do a nice foraging simulation and get at issues of predation and predation risk just by moving acorns at fixed distances from a tree. I use that as a metaphor for safety. So yeah, my biologist friend Joel there is a no child left indoors kind of guy, and is definitely pushing in these directions. We're also working with things like camera traps and having kids go out and collect images of animals in their backyard. So, you know, where phenomena are accessible and I can get to them in that way, I love working with the real stuff. But in the middle of winter, or with phenomena that are, you know, too distant to do, I think both of them are good. Yes?
So I really like this as a way to get kids engaged, because I think sometimes we try and explain concepts that seem really arbitrary and the things that we as scientists, you know, understand in a deeper way, but it's really hard to tailor it to third grade class, you know, to explain. And since we'll never have that real world experience to become scientists, it's nice. I like what you said. My question is, do the different classrooms engage with one another in terms of, as they're acquiring data, are they siloed, or are you using this also as an opportunity for them to collaborate? And have you thought about spreading to other schools, where then, you know, in terms of the sharing model moving forward, you could really see this sort of rich environment for collaboration that actually is a skill that some scientists are not very good at. And it would be really great to have young scientists or people that we might want to become scientists in the future to start thinking about collaboration and how to collaborate towards real-world food problems at an early age.
You know, we've made some attempts. I mean, I agree with what you're saying. For instance, in the Wokology exercise, we did work with two adjacent classrooms and allowed the bugs could crawl from one classroom to the other. Okay, so the kids, you know, were experiencing the shared phenomenon. It's a little bit of a tricky situation because we have this embedding sense that the action is here. This is the locus. So when we start to make that virtual, so it's a difficult balance. But I think we're going to be doing a project this spring, actually, where we're using the camera traps between some classrooms in Chicago and Toronto. And we're going to be sharing those data sets back and forth between those two. So it's a little bit, you know, hard to find it, hard to share that virtual space and still make it so much about here. Yeah.
Along the same lines, but looking at collaboration and cooperativeness, right, a methodology or a strategy in the classroom. I love the controlled chaos. That's one of the characteristics of activity-based instruction, right? But I was wondering, like in the first video, you had all these kids that in some stations 10 ran to those, others only a couple. If you had, not in the last one, you have a smaller group, have you incorporated any of the elements of a more structured strategy? Let's say, you know, you assign goals or you limit the number of students that can work in a... Have you incorporated those elements to see if you can change the participation?
We have usually left those decisions in the hands of teachers. So, in fact, some teachers, they gauge their kids. If the kids are self-motivated, you know, and self-organizing enough to do this successfully, I think they're trying to step back a little and give them that latitude. In that class, in the Roomquake class, that teacher actually was fairly rigorous. This group is going to this station. This group is going to that station. And you hear him in the background. Maybe you didn't hear him, but I hear his voice saying, be sure to try, you know, I can't remember his language, but, you know, try different roles. Do different things, okay? So he became the cheerleader for role distribution. But it is a challenge, and it also, you know, it gets into issues of how many activity sites you provide as well, and how you can distribute that. But my attitude is that I'd rather put that in the hands of the teachers.
I'm not stopping things. I would like to see if there are any questions from out there in the
operator.
Participants on the phone, to ask your question, please press star 1. Again, to ask your question, please press star 1. One moment, please.
Thank you.
went back there first and then you.
So you had one slide on learning outcomes. Have you had enough time to look at long-term retention? Do kids remember the concepts better because they were so active, or do they remember the fun?
I haven't done any longitudinal tracking across grades. They remember. Certainly they remembered experientially. Because I live, part of this work was in my neighborhood. I would see kids in the grocery store 4 years later. They would recount these experiences to me. We haven't really done a lot of delayed post-tests on the kids to see what their retention looks like, to be honest. I'm not sure that I have the measure that I'm really interested in anyway. Whether they remember exactly how to read a seismogram is less important to me than the notion that they're defining themselves as legitimized investigators. And if I had a way to measure that over time, I think I would do well on that measure. Okay, I think there is a development of that, and I don't know how to measure that very well, and I can't believe that that's a long-term effect that I'm very likely to get on any sort of immediate or even short-term delayed post-test. So yes, it would be a good thing to do, and I should probably do more of it, but we can't do it.
So I have a question about scalability and the plans for scaling. My daughter, a sixth grader, is now actually studying. I would love better teacher would have done Walcology, because I think my daughter would have loved it. Unfortunately, I'm a biologist, so it's sad to see my daughter bored by it. So I think this would have been great. But, is this something that you can now give to, teacher in Tacoma Park Middle School and say, do this?
To be honest, today, no.
Okay.
And I think that, Natalie and I were just having this discussion this morning. From a technological perspective, yes, we could deliver it. Mm-hmm. Okay. For a teacher to prepare, to enact this sort of a unit, I'm not an expert in professional development, but I know the value of professional development and the need for it, and the need for other sorts of scaffolding. Not only is it a one-time PD sort of thing, but over time and in the moment, we need to provide additional tools for teachers to as the activity is going along. They need exemplars of what other teachers done. They need some, we can hand them the lesson plans, but this is not something that we can readily throw over the fence. Technology is not such a problem. I think we could deliver the technology. Early versions of this in Roomquake, we had a web portal where you could go in and you could configure your quakes. You described the room, you told us where the seismographs were, we could do that for you. Okay, that's not a problem. But that doesn't really prepare you to think about distributions of earthquakes and more deeply about the math of trilateration or wave propagation. So so I think the sad answer is no, not yet. And the other part of the answer is I'm not really, my expertise is not really scaling up and thinking about how to do that. I'm hoping somebody else would like to do that with me, but I don't really have the skills to do that. I don't know, what that's about. Yes?
You mentioned in the beginning the importance of embodiment in learning, and we now know more and more, even in social robotics, that people respond to the embodied thing much better than to the virtual. Now, how in your design do you, because people also remember better, because this girl, which was holding this,
yes.
Pretend drill,
yeah.
Will remember that movement.
Yes.
So how do you design, your balance, because you have to have some virtual stuff there. How do you balance embodiment with virtual?
I think, increasingly I try to think of ways to make things as embodied as I can within the constraints of the space. So, for some activities like Roomquake, there's embodiment, I suppose, in the enactment of trilateration, but that's not really a scientific practice of seismologists. They don't do it exactly that way. I guess I just look for as many opportunities as I can, and I'm more and more interested in the enactment of the physical practice of science. I don't know how. It's a case by case sort of thing.
So you
strive for more. Pardon me.
You don't have a method, you would say,
I don't have a method, I would say, trying to maximize opportunities for, for physical activity. Also, because kids like to move around.
Operator, are there any questions?
There are no questions at this time.
All right, we'll go ahead and conclude this webinar.
Thank you all for your time.
I want to put in a plug for 2:30 this afternoon. Come back here. The computer's set up in the back. They'll be around the room. You will get to be part of the solar system.
You can be put on your inner fifth grader.
Your inner fifth grader, yes. And the other thing I want to do is another plug. The next one of these is Friday, February 21st. It will be Kurt Squire from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and he will talk about games for learning, and in particular, crowdsourced citizen science kind of games for learning, and what it takes to learn from those and not just participate. So I think it's going to be equally fun. Thank you, Tom.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.